I think beginnings are interesting things, really. You know, we have not much form, lots of possibility. So there's excitement, there's maybe fear, there's a lot of confusion around or not knowing. And when we take a topic like, as the title, as a friend just asked me what the title of this was, this whole program, and it's the title is Becoming True of Voice, which is an interesting, it's an Egyptian phrase. And it refers to a process that was right at the heart of ancient Egyptian religion. And a process that gets translated down the ages. And the one way of describing it is becoming justified. Now, one of the things the Egyptians believed happened to you when you died is you. You come into the presence of the god Osiris, who is the god of the dead, and the hope is that you are accepted as somebody who is justified, who is someone who speaks with true voice, and who therefore will live with the community of the good, the community of those who live in a kind of Elysian, a sort of beautiful fields of grain and trees that ripen by themselves, and you work in the fields, but you work in a, so it's a sort of idealized version of the Egyptian world, really. But you only get there if you are justified. And there's a fundamental image that you find in the Book of the Dead, which is called the weighing of the soul. And in one of the papers I'm going to give you, there's pictures of the weighing of the soul, but it's essentially the dead person is led by the god Anubis, who is the guide of the soul, to a set of scales. And there the dead person's heart, called the Ab, is weighed against the feather of Maat, the feather of truth. And the dead person at this point has to make something called the negative confession, who has to say to the assessors of the scales, has to proclaim their innocence. Who has to say things like, I have never oppressed my fellow man. I have never spoken in truth. Like, you know, so in a way, there's that is entirely ludicrous. Actually, that it would apply to no human being. And from an Orthodox point of view, it really looks like a sort of, there are spells in the Book of the Dead that constrain your heart from telling the truth about you.
The priest, the
dead person would carry the spell with them, but in the funerary priest, the Anubis priest, will have spoken the spell to stop the person's heart telling the truth to the assessors.
So the assessors can be fooled.
That's the idea behind it. But ancient Egyptian, of course, has lots and lots of layers. And people are very, very romantic about Egypt. But this would be the Egyptian equivalent of the medieval custom of buying freedom from purgatory, the papal indulgences of buying forgiveness. So this is like the ancient Egyptian version of this. But there's a more profound version, profound understanding of the weighing of the scales, where actually, as you make the declaration, I have not, you become aware that you have. I have not lied. And then you start to remember all the times you've lied. And the And the deeper understanding is that the part is you offer these parts of you, the parts of you that you offer your shame, your shadow, to the Eater of Souls, so that you can come in. So actually, it's the experience of the scales is an experience of encountering all your shadow energies, but offering that up, offering up your mistakes, your errors, so that you can come into a degree of balance, and then you can come into the presence of the deeper soul, which is represented by the god Osiris and the goddesses Isis and Nephthys. Now, this very ancient kind of process of justification, you find, it's an interesting illustration of how these ideas transmit through time. Because one of the things, the judgment of the dead, you find very powerfully in Christian tradition. You also find the image of the scales, and in Glastonbury on St. Michael's Tower, you will find the image of St. Michael holding a pair of scales. And this is, you know, thousands of years later, is the echo of the ancient Egyptian process of the weighing of the soul. And the Archangel Michael, in some ways, in Christian tradition, is an analog or an echo of the ancient Egyptian god Anubis, Anpu, the guide of the soul. Because in Christian tradition, Michael accompanies the soul on their after death journey. So when we touch these ancient kind of traditions, one of the things we're going to discover over these 2 years is that these traditions are transmitted through time. The idea of being a justified person is still a strong idea in the culture. And the Ettrick shepherd, James Hogg, writes a book in the sort of 19th century called Memoirs of a Justified Sinner. All about his relationship with the devil and shadow, and it's the same kind of idea. So this idea of embracing the shadow, working with the inner darkness, finding a balance, and therefore meeting the deeper aspect of your own soul, is really the process that we're going to be looking at. And as part of that process, we will see how some of these very old, 5,000-year-old ideas persist within the culture. Another example of an Egyptian word, really, that has remained and retained its meaning over thousands of years, is the word Amen, that is at the end of the Lord's Prayer, and often attached to the end of many Christian and Jewish prayers. Now, the word Amen, it comes from is an Egyptian word. It is the name of the creator god Amen or Amun-Ra, who is the god who creates the universe. And he creates the universe by saying, "Let it be so. I speak it in my name." And the word Amen, well, the reason the word Amen is at the end of a prayer, it seals it. It says, "May this prayer be true. Let it be so." Or you get the colloquial expression, "Amen to that, brother. I say Amen." You know, and this... It's interesting, you know, this name that is spoken on the banks of the Nile comes out of Sudan originally, so it comes out of Africa because initially a local god becomes the great god of Egypt. As the ancient Egyptian temples vanish, the whole tradition happens, and the word Amen, the ancient Egyptian word, gets taken up into something called Proto-Semitic, which is the ancestral language of Arabic, of Aramaic, and of Hebrew, and becomes a word of power, a word that says this is a sacred word, this means let something be. It's a word of will and creation. And it comes down all thousands of years later into our time. of many, many, well, and as we explore the Book of Gates, we will discover many other kind of similarities. There's, for example, in the Book of Gates, you find one of the places you go to is a lake of fire that is that is also a lake of sweet water. In the Book of Revelation, one of the things that happens to the poor damned is they are pushed into a lake of fire. Another image you get in the Book of Gates is the justified ones are given shining white linen to wear. The ancients who sit around the throne of the Ancient of Days in the Book of Revelation are wearing shining white clothes. Now there's a whole sort of pattern really that you can see that emerges initially in ancient Egypt, that is transmitted through the Near East, that goes into Greece, and so these images, these ideas, these echoes just are transmitted over time, changing shape, of course, adapting to local circumstances, but retaining a really kind of similar intention from the thing of the beginning. And so the deep intention really about justification or becoming true of voice is that one becomes somebody who is aligned with the deep energies of creation. And by speaking, by being true of voice, that this whole thing you have in Egypt is about the universe being spoken into being. You find it also in the book, in the Gospel of John, in the beginning is the Word, or another way to say that might be to say in the beginning was the conversation. So this idea of being true of voice is that as you speak truth, so the true thing appears. You affirm the reality of something. And there's a certain way in which we are all continuously affirming, recreating, moment by moment, our sense of self and universe. Now that's happening subliminally, faster than thought, faster than... So actually we don't generally experience it as a living process. We experience it as, this is how things are. This is me, this is Ian, this is Ian's universe. But actually what is happening, if we can kind of slow things down a bit and pay very close attention, what we see happening is a continual arising out of the mysteriousness and a mysterious void place, pregnant void, that continually emerges as Ian in Ian's universe. And so what we're going to be doing is looking into that process. And the process of justification, in a way, is that process where we examine this, where we discover, in a way, what is true for us in this process, and what have we assimilated, what have we covered ourselves over with, that therefore is not true for us. So the deep process, in some ways, is a process of uncovering, aletheia, uncovering what is true. Aletheia.
It's the heroine in Philip
Pullman's novels. The alethiometer. She has the alethiometer, which shows truth. Yes, and the phrase aletheia, the a before aletheia is a phrase of negation. So it means you're not creating, you're uncovering what is true. You're taking away that which obscures truth.
Working with, wasn't he, with undercutting what actually thought was.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. Yes, that's right. Now, what we're going to be doing is using some ideas from the Kabbalah to look at this process. We're going to be using the Tree of Life, which I've done a mock-up on the board. Now the Tree of Life is another ancient image. Its beginning is in ancient Egypt as the great tree of Heliopolis, and literally in its kind of graphic form, which is, you know, it's a tamarisk tree or an acacia tree sometimes, but it represents that the literally the connected experience of all living beings. And engaging with the Tree of Life, in the Egyptian tradition, those who go through the justification process discover that their names are literally written on the leaves of the Tree of Life. So you are part of the tree, you have your own leaf. So the ancient image is that each of us are, although separate and operating in our own sphere, we are deeply connected to the tree that connects all living beings, that connects the whole universe.
Is that life after life?
Life after life. It would be a sort of continuous, ongoing kind of process. In a certain sense, you might say that in life after life, we forget and we remember. So the process of justification, in a way, is a continual act of remembering our connectedness to everything and finding our individual place again. And finding finding the essential nature of our individual place. For every leaf on the Tree of Life is needed and precious. Now, this very ancient idea, again, is one of the things that gets transmitted through time. You find it in the book of Genesis, of course, in the story of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. And you have these two trees in the Eden story. You have the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, which is the experience of separation and opposites that are not in union. That whole bit of the kind of that story of Genesis.
Sorry, opposites that are not
connected. So the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. This is the opposite tree from the Tree of Life. The Tree of Life connects everything. So there is nothing that is not connected, that doesn't have a relationship with everything else. But the experience of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And the Genesis story is very powerful, it's a story that's caused enormous harm in some of the ways it's been applied in human life, because it's been used really as a way of creating shame and separating the sheep from the goats, the good from the bad. It's been used certainly as a massively to oppress women in patriarchal society. The sin of Eve. Because Eve being the bad person who tempts Adam away from goodness. In a certain sense, we live between those two trees, because the parts of us that are shamed, the parts of us that separate, the parts of us that fear connection, in a certain sense, hang out in aspects of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Whereas alongside that, or in the middle of this tree, in the middle of all our experience, is the potential to connect to the Tree of Life. To come into an experience of interconnectedness. Now, over time, lots of different versions of this tree happen, but in the Renaissance, and Athanasius Kircher creates a version of this tree based on his experience of working with the Jewish tradition of Provence and of southern France, northern Spain, and we start to see this diagram that I've put on the board, which we're going to look at a lot over time. This image is an image really of it's an image both of the universe and of the human soul. So the Tree of Life, imagine you're standing on the earth, and that bottom sphere there is earth. Then you're looking up, then the sphere just above you is the moon. Then on the left side you've got the planet Mercury. The right side you've got the planet Venus. In the middle you've got the sun. Then you've got Mars and Jupiter, and then you have the sense of deep space, so you've got this sense of a great heading out to the edge of the solar system, where you have the planet Saturn. Opposite, you have the sphere of the thick stars, a great field of stars. And then right at the top, you have the theoretical center of the universe, that is the root of creation. So this is an image, so this is a medieval image of the universe. It's also a set of categories, a set of ways of making sense of the universe. It's also an image of the human soul. So the bottom sphere is the body. The lunar sphere is about is to do with the unconscious, the kind of place of images, all the things that we would associate with being lunar. The planet Mercury is associated with the mind and thought. Planet Venus is associated with feeling and emotion. The sense of the sun, the centralizing presence of the sun, represents the sense of stillness, presence, becoming, creating balance. The planet Mars represents all the martial energies, clarity, focus. The planet Jupiter represents abundance, love, compassion. The three spheres at the top represent the deep, it's like the kind of the deep roots of our being. So we have the planet Saturn, which in that medieval time, it's the planet that encompasses all the rest. It's the planet that holds all the rest in a great womb. So it's the deep mother, the deep archetypal feminine. It's polarized with the field of stars that are continually seen as fertilizing and bringing your life into being. So there's the kind of the archetypal masculine. And the sphere Keter, which is the sort of both the root and the crown of the tree, it represents our deepest sense of ourselves. Part of ourselves, the Egyptian called Asar-u-Nefa, the Osiris made beautiful, myself made beautiful. So the Tree of Life, when I was taught this by a lovely man called Ernest Butler in, how many years ago, too many years ago to think really, but it would have been 1973. So when I said, if we go turn time back and we go back to 1973, I encountered two Yorkshiremen, a man called Ernest Butler and another man called Tom Ollerman, and they teach me about the Tree of Life. And the Tree of Life, they say, is a really helpful thing to relate to because it connects you to your own soul and connects you to the soul of the universe, which is quite a handy thing to do. But Ernest used to describe the Tree of Life as being like the Rosetta Stone. Now, the point of the Rosetta Stone, if you've seen the Rosetta Stone in the British Museum, it is an artifact that enables you to unlock meaning. So the Rosetta Stone has a proclamation in Greek, in Coptic, and in hieroglyphics. Not a very interesting proclamation. It's all about goods and commerce, really. So it in itself, in its own content, is not so useful. But what it enabled us to do was to, by comparing meaning, to discover the meaning of the unknown. So by understanding the Coptic words and the Greek words, by inference, they started to understand the meaning of hieroglyphs. Now, the Tree of Life is like that. So it's not about being an expert on the Tree of Life, and people do. There are many books written about the Tree of Life, but it's meaning, its purpose really, is to help us embody and understand the unknown. And we do that in a sense by understanding or embodying the archetypal structure of the tree within us. And as we understand that archetypal structure, the system of relationships that the tree is, when we encounter ancient Egyptian texts, medieval texts, or just life experience, the tree enables us to translate the meaning of those encounters into an experience, a lived experience of our own relationship of being ourselves within the living universe. The tree is a mediating structure. So, I'm going to teach you a couple of fundamental practices, which are some of the first practices I ever did. And I still do them, because they help me remember. They help bring me back into relationship with this structure that mediates. First one is a little ritualistic structure called the Kabbalistic cross. It's oddly similar to the last phrase of the Lord's Prayer: "For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, for ever and ever, Amen." So that phrase, you know, the Lord's Prayer, that kind of phrase, is actually sort of an add-on, really. It comes out of a Jewish tradition, but this little practice called the Kabbalistic cross is a way of working with the body and working with visualization to bring within you a sense of vertical and horizontal connection. In a sense, it creates that sense of balance that the Egyptians are talking about when they talk about the weighing of the soul. It's a really small practice that's very easy to overlook because it seems quite simple. It is simple, but it has a lot of depth in it. Now, all the practices that we will be looking at have to begin with a sense of body, first of all. Because what we're looking at really here is how to embody the sacred, how to become present to ourselves, present to our senses, we enter into a direct relationship with the universe and what's happening right now at the moment. So the very first thing I would like you to do is to, this practice can be done either standing or sitting. I'm going to stand, so you can either stand with me or you can just sit upright. That's if you don't want to stand, it doesn't really matter. Practice is fine whichever way you do it. But I'm going to do it just standing. So what you do, first of all, is you, sitting or standing, you notice your connection to the ground. So sitting on the ground, standing on the ground, feel that connection. Just notice gravity. Notice your spine. Notice the tensions in your body. Letting your body, as far as you can, relax, letting tension just drop down through the body, down into the ground. So standing on the ground, standing in space, sitting on the ground, sitting in space. And just noticing that uprightness. Noticing your shape. Noticing your breath coming and going, not interfering with it at this point, just letting your breath come and go. Feeling the earth beneath you, feeling the sky above you, noticing space around you. And above your head, I want you just to sense or visualize a flame, a triple flame of white, intense white light. So you don't have to visualize it very clearly, but just have a sense of source, a sense of white fire just above you. And again, just feeling the solidity of the earth, feeling that sense of the white flame above your head. Just sensing that as a spiritual source. And then slowly bring your dominant hand, so if you're left-handed, use your left hand, if you're right-handed, use your right hand. Just bring your hand up to your forehead and just touching your forehead. We say together the Hebrew word ate. Ate. Then bring your hand slowly down the body, down to about the level of your solar plexus, where your hand just points downwards. And just sense or visualize a column of light going straight through your body down into the ground. As it touches the ground, we say together, Malchut. Malchut. And slowly bring your hand to your right shoulder, where you imagine or sense a sphere of red light. And here we say, Ve'gebura. Ve'gebura. Now bring your hand to your left shoulder, visualizing a sheet of white light coming into a blue sphere. And here we say Ve'gedula. Ve'gedula. And you bring your hands together at the center in a sort of prayer gesture. And here you feel a sphere of brilliant golden light, right where the cross comes together. And here we say, Le'olam Amen. Le'olam Amen. Bring your hands apart and let the radiance flow out. And then bring your hands back down to the side again. Now we're going to do it again. So again, just begin by sensing your body, feeling that vertical axis, notice your shoulders, notice the horizontal axis. Again, sense that the triple flame above your head, pure white flame, like diamond lights. And then just bringing your hand up, touching your forehead, we say Ate. Ate. Bring your hand down, feel the sheet of light going straight down the body, down into the earth, pointing your hand downwards, and say Malchut. Malchut. The right shoulder, feel a sphere of red light, Ve'gevura. Ve'gevura. Left shoulder, sheet of light, blue sphere. Ve'gedula. Ve'gedula. To the center, Le'olam Amen. Le'olam Amen. Hands down to the side. Once again, sensing down into the earth, feeling the center line of your body, feeling the space around you. And once again, bring your hand to your forehead. Ate. And Malchut. Down. Right shoulder, Vegevura. Vegevura. Left shoulder, Vegedila. Vegedila. Center, Leolam, Amen. Leolam, Amen. One last time. Ade. To the center, Leolam, Amen. Again, just feel the body. Notice the effect of the chant and the visualization. And then just slowly bring your attention out. And if you're standing up, sit down. And then we'll just talk a bit about this before we break for lunch. What that exercise does is connect the top of the tree, the sphere Keter. This is Ate, thou, to the bottom of the tree, Malchut, the kingdom. So it's that sense of the descent of light right through the body from the deeper, from the highest or the deepest place to the most outer place. It then works with the two side spheres of Gevura, which is the martial energy, Gedula, which is the Jupiter energy, which, so these energies of we call them severity and mercy. So these two energies that are about clarity, focus, and that are about loving and opening. You could call it the work of the sword and the work of the cup. You bring, having balanced, so the intention of that little practice is the intention to embody the spiritual and to create a balance between the energies, between the opposites of our own nature, and to bring that to the center point, which is where we bring our hands to the center, to the heart point of Tiferet, and we say Le'olam Amen. So which means let it be this way forever, everywhere. Le'olam means the worlds, and that word Amen, let it be so. So in that little that little practice, and I have a handout with a practice on, so which I will give you in a bit. You're bringing together, you're recapitulating this whole process the Egyptians talked about as the process of justification, because you're making yourself present, you're bringing the light right down into your flesh, and then you're balancing the opposite, and you're coming to a sense of center and balance. So in a sense, you create a sense of balance within yourself and potentially within the wider world, because everything is connected. So that's the basic little practice. Let's just see what your experience of that has been before we break for lunch. What was it like doing it?
Certainly expanded my field.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. What was the difference? What did you notice?
Well, I suppose I'm used to doing it on my own, so that felt a little challenging.
Yeah, of course.
But my attention wasn't entirely on me doing it. It was a little bit aware of voices and movements on my earth, but...
Yeah.
But I thought that was interesting, because I thought, well, I would like to be able to feel the same sense of balance and expansion that I get when I do it on my own.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. It's a different process, isn't it? Because you're having to, because it's a different rhythm. Because you know, because it's slower or quicker than you might do it on your own, and so there's a harmonizing that of being with others. So doing a practice of this together, even if you're very used to it on your own, it becomes more challenging to do it with others because you're having to accommodate different rhythms. So that in itself is interesting, I think. Yeah, of course, absolutely.
I found it very odd because when we were doing that, I was visualising it in my body.
Yeah, totally.
Which I'd never done before.
Yeah.
Which was interesting.
Yeah.
You know, when I've done the Kabbalistic process, I haven't had that kind of visualisation of the colours, so that was really good.
Mm.
And also this, the triple...
Flame.
Is that supposed to link into... the central
image. Yes, it's that image actually, yes, exactly. Yeah. The shin at the centre. Yeah. Shin at the centre, yeah. Yeah.
And the other thing is I was always taught Leo Lam, you visualise again heaven earth as in a kind of mental way. You know, let it be on heaven as on as
Oh blimey, earth. Right, yeah, okay, that's complicated.
I don't know if that was
Yeah, that would be too cognitive for me because actually that moment low light, it's the worlds, it's like everything. So,
yes.
So my experience of that moment is like just a moment of you're just offering it all up. You're offering up that sense of whatever you have manifested into the wider universe, and so there's an opening thing for me to do like heaven and earth, and that would actually take me out of the process really.
Because I mean, you've opened it up.
Yeah. Yeah. No, good. It's a lovely practice. I've done it for many years.
It sort of orientates you like like a sort of ordnance survey kind of on all directions.
Absolutely, totally.
It means you're here.
Now. Yeah, here now, exactly. That's right. And it takes into, you know, and it opens you to the different potential layers of yourself. But also it creates this sense of balance of opposites and discovery, you know, and of course often you discover you're not balanced or, you know, so but it invites in the possibility of balance, which is one of the things I like about it, really.
Well? It's a rich reminder of places we lose so easily. And I felt quite pulled from the stars. I came with the expression of being allowing myself to be fed by the stars.
Nice, lovely. Yeah. Well, there's something about that uprightness, because one of the things that's interesting about that whole exercise is you asked the invitation to be upright, to literally be, to be between heaven and earth. So it's a sort of feel gravity. So not to lose connection with the earth, to be embodied, but also to be in that bigger field.
The opposite of being in church when you're always this all the time.
No, the idea is that your body opens, right? So that's the whole kind of, you know, in some ways the Le Lam gesture is an opening gesture. You can sometimes just open you can do that. You can open your arms very wide, you know, and then you kind of, can sometimes pick up crucifixion images when you do that, but which isn't the image we're looking for particularly, but it's a sense of embrace, right? It's embracing the universe, balancing the universe.
So vulnerability.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, that's right. That's a nice way to put it. Yeah, that's lovely. I like that. Yeah, that's exactly it. It's an stretching out, opening the heart, embracing the world. And you're held, of course, by this pillar that is kind of going right down into the depth, right up into the heights.
So, no visualization for Malkuth at all? I mean, as in...
No, that's much more a sense of no. It's much more the sense there is much more of density, and so we've established. I feel like we've established the sense of Malchut by feeling the earth beneath our feet, right? So I mean, you could visualize Malchut. There's no reason why you shouldn't. But it's not really very necessary in this practice. We're gonna after lunch. I'm going to go over something called the middle pillar practice, where you do visualize Malchut. But in the most important thing about this is to keep the visualization as simple as possible, and to have it connect to the felt sense, to the sense of the body, really. So it's sort of a, you know, that's the key thing in some ways.
The Christ, the heart, and yep. the kind of glowing, the sun, and the glowing outwards.
Yep.
That felt nice.
Yeah.
And a kind of, so I had a little mental thing about going, oh, this is interesting, because the chakra system is just in one line.
Mm.
Well, I don't know. But this felt like actually it incorporates that, the horizontal.
Yeah.
Not
No, that's right, yeah. I mean, it does do that.
I was just glad we did it several times.
Oh, yeah, no.
To take in, what are the words, what are the colours, what are the gestures?
Yeah, we'll keep on working with it, right? I think the whole point about this is repetition is the key, right? So these basic exercises we're going to keep on doing over and over. And you know, you can... because initially these odd Hebrew words and colours, there's a lot to think about. Although it's interesting, I was having a conversation with Faye actually and some other people last week about how the usefulness of exercises that have a certain degree of complexity in them, because they engage the complexity of our own nature. You know, every now and then, you know, if you come across people who are doing things like, you know, putting you down spiritually sometimes, I don't know if you've experienced people doing that to you, where somebody will say, the classic phrase is, well, of course, it's all in the breath. Just don't need any of this complexity. Just breathe. And that's not wrong, but actually, if you could just be with the breath, that's an intensely complex, deep practice that you know would probably take you all your life to learn if you were in special circumstances when nothing else was going on. It was actually for those of us who live in the world and the exercises that have some complexity engage the different parts of our nature. So they engage the thinking part of our nature, the feeling part of our nature, the sensed part of our nature, the place where they bring up this whole place we bring up. I can't bloody remember that, or as what happens to me these days. Oh God, I've forgotten that thing I used to remember. I used to know. Is it brings up aspects of your own nature into the practice, which is what it's supposed to do in a way. So the learning of the practice, and so don't be worried about trying to do the big danger is thinking we have to do things perfectly. And actually, we just have to keep trying to do things and get interested in what happens when we do them. So these basic practices we'll come back to and they will just get embodied in you. And actually, eventually they'll be second nature. Mm-hmm. By the time we come to the end of the 2 years, you will be doing the Kabbalistic cross like you've been doing it for 100 years. You know, it just gets built in.
Mm-hmm. Can you put the words?
You've got the. I'm going to give you a handout with the words, so that. So that no, I've got a handout with the words, so that's no, definitely. I mean that's. So yeah, I mean it doesn't matter really. We're just it's the practice of doing it together, but then the words are you know again I'll go over the words. Ate is the first one. It means thou. It's the. Reaching into that kind of the image that represents the spiritual, the flame.
Ate.
It's Hebrew, so it. I mean, I would have to write it in Hebrew. It didn't matter. The English is more useful. Ate. Ate.
That's what's
going on. It means thou. It means the spirit. The it's a sort of, acknowledgement of the divine.
Thou.
And then the next word is Malchut, which is M-A-L. K-U-T-H. M-A-L-K-U-T-H. Malchut. It means the kingdom. It means the body. It means the earth. It means everything that is manifest. Yeah, on the tree. That's right. It's there. It's right down at the feet. Solar plex present. This is more the solar plexus point there. So it's Ate, which is the top of the tree. Malchut, the bottom of the tree. So we're connecting the height and the depth. The next word is Ve, which is V-E. Gebvura, G-U-B.
So when I'm looking at this, sorry.
Is it looking there?
Yes.
When you're looking at what, that?
Yeah, so are we here?
We're here. If you imagine the tree is like behind you, right? So my right shoulder is there. My left shoulder is there. My kind of solar plexus is there. My feet are there. My head is there.
And what word is this one, sorry?
Right, this one is, first is V, it's this way, it's V-E. And then it's Gevura, which is G-E-B-U-R-A-H. G-E-B-U-R-A-H. Now in Hebrew, the B sound is a sort of B-V, so it's Gevura. But it's an odd expression. But don't worry about too much about the pronunciation, but you will just hear me saying something that sounds like a cross between a B and a V. So that's Vigibura, which means the severity or the clarity.
So that's the sword one.
That's the image of the sword, right? So that's the sword.
So what is the V stuck in front?
Thine is the kingdom. V is and thee. Oh, it's an and. So it's a conjunction. Yeah. So it means and thee, and that's why, and the severity, Vigidula, and the love. Then we're with. So yeah. Okay. So then we go to the left shoulder.
This is the blue. Mars also.
That's the Mars, right? Vegavura is Mars, and it's the martial energy. It's the sword. We come to the quality of love then of the left shoulder, which is the and the phrase there is Ve again, which means and Gedula, which is G-E-D-U-L-A-H, Vegedula, which means the love. So the thine is the kingdom, the clarity or the severity, and the love. So then we come to the solar plexus point, which is Tiferet, the heart center, and the word here is Le'olam Amen. So Eli, Le, and O-L-A-M, Le Olam. It means forever and everything. That means the world. I mean, the literal translation is the world, but the world means both time and space. It means everything. So thine is the power, the severity. Thine is the kingdom, the power, the severity, the love, forever, everywhere. And then Amen. Let it be so. So you're aligning with that quality that brings the presence through all the worlds and balances the worlds.
Amen, not Amen.
Amen, A-M-E-N. May it be so.
There's a lot in this, isn't there?
There is a lot in it. It's a simple sounding little thing, but there's a huge amount in it, really. Holds the whole principles of the tree in it somewhere.
So
So does that process develop to include the other areas, or is it a self-contained?
It's a self-contained practice. I mean, you can add other things to it, but it's like a decentralized practice, yeah. Right? That contains all the rest of it, really, without the details. So it's like stripping it down to the most fundamental aspects of the tree. The practice we'll do after lunch will be about working with the whole vertical aspect of the tree. We'll work with that sphere and that and that and that and that, and that's a slightly different exercise that involves the body. But this first exercise is almost the most important exercise in some ways. You could just do this all your life, and it would deepen and deepen and deepen. Really, it's a sort of.
Specific.
Yeah, it's called the Kabbalistic Cross.
Which is the Lord's Prayer.
Yeah, it's oddly, it's the last verse of the Lord's Prayer. Thine is the kingdom, the power and the glory, forever and ever. Amen. Mm-hmm. So it's very interesting, really.
That seems like a sort of add-on, doesn't it?
Well, it is an add-on. Actually, literally, that's true. It is an add-on, because a Catholic, for example, would not say that phrase. In Catholicism, it ends whatever comes just before that. They don't say that. They don't say the final codicil. It comes. I don't remember now when it got added, but it's not. But it's you don't find it in Catholicism. You find it in Anglicanism. I don't know. It'd be interesting to look that up. Actually, I'd maybe be curious. I'll look into that and see.
We forgive trespasses.
Yes, trespass against us.
Yeah.
But lead us not into temptation. So that, deliver us from evil. That's where it ends. Amen. Right. So it ends in the deliver. Yeah. So actually, the Catholic version, it ends in the deliver us from evil, and then that's with amen. Deliver us from evil. Amen. That's interesting. I'll have to look that up.